Welcome to Radio at Firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters. Firehouse.com brings you the leaders of the nation's fire, rescue, and EMS services, the top columnists and educators, and today's most important issues, headlines, and comments. Listen right on your desktop or download and listen on the go to Firehouse.com.
With less money and fewer firefighters, departments have to use their people in the smartest and safest ways. So the next time you're speccing an apparatus, think manual and remote control monitors. Why, TFT practically reinvented radio frequency handheld controls for monitors, flowing from 15 up to 2,000 gallons per minute. Since every firefighter counts, so does every purchase. We can help maximize your team's Firestream's performance today. Visit us at www.tft.com or give us a call at 800-348-2686.
Hello and welcome to the Apparatus Architects here on radio at firehouse.com. This is Peter Matthews, and I'm here today with Apparatus Architects Michael Wilbur and Tom Shand. Just a quick note to let you know that we'll be doing a live show during the Firehouse Expo. It'll be held on Friday, July 27th at 10:15 a.m. in room 308. So please stop by and join the show if you have any questions on an upcoming order that you may be placing or speccing out a rig, or you need to know some of the latest and greatest. Please do stop by and participate in the show. It'll be great to see you. And without anything else, let's get the show rolling. We have a lot of stuff to go over this month.
So, Mike and Tom, we're very happy to have all the listeners here today. And here's our rundown of the program. We're going to start out by talking briefly about the, we're in the middle of the IAFC week of our safety stand down, and the title of this month's, this year's program is Ready to Respond, so we're going to be talking a little bit about that. We're going to be talking about one of Mike and Tom's favorite concepts about front bumper extensions. When do you need them, and when should you consider maybe shortening them up a little bit? Several of the shows that we have attended so far this year, we've looked at some of these front bumper extensions, and to say they're getting out of control would be an understatement. So Brother Mike and I will be talking about that. We'll also be talking about raised roof cabs, different sizes that are available, and when things are might be useful to you to integrate into your apparatus design, and when there might be some cab heights that may actually, particularly with aerial devices, not assist you in the design of the vehicle. Then a subject that's very dear to Brother Wilbur's heart. We're going to be talking about the differences between a mid-mount versus a rear-mount aerial device. There's been a lot of discussions lately, particularly with departments that are considering purchasing a rig, and the fact that the majority of apparatus builders build, and whether it's an aerial ladder or a tower, both a mid-mount as well as a rear-mount turntable device, what the inherent advantages and disadvantages of each of those are. And we'll finish up with answering a few questions and talking about a few upcoming events for things that are going to be happening later on this summer. So with respect to the IAFC safety stand down that we're involved in here, we're in day two this week with the concept of ready to respond. Michael, since you work on the job in the city, well, what activities, if any in particular, are FDNY doing to be able to address the safety stand down?
Once again, my job at the FDNY is completely on board with the stand down. As I worked yesterday, I received a DVD and package of materials for drill topics throughout the week of the stand down to go through, and hints and things that we need to be doing in station and on the road for a safer response. So for the second year in a row, the FDNY has really embraced national fallen firefighters and the IAFC and all the other groups, the program for the stand down.
Well, the concept of this year's program of Ready to Respond really does hit home. As most of our listeners are aware of, so far this year, there's been an exceedingly high number of very tragic apparatus-related accidents, and you can't help but think that many of them could have been preventable had there been sufficient policies or SOGs in place, and most importantly, training in place for these people to understand, you know, once the alarm comes in and the adrenaline starts flowing, there's very, very little difference between having the hit and the proverbial near miss. And the ready to respond theme for this year's safety stand down is something that really needs to be taken to heart. And whether we're talking about, you know, pre-planning for the incident or having sufficient alarm dispatch policies in place so that the members know what apparatus is due to respond in what order and what the proper staffing levels of the apparatus are, together with all those topics that we talked about during our last podcast that were specific to the apparatus itself. There's innumerable concepts that you can embrace here with your department to take this year's safety stand down extremely seriously, to understand that we're in the emergency service delivery business and everyone is susceptible to having an unfortunate incident. And in a lot of cases, the difference again between having that little near miss that sometimes you may read on Billy G's column at firefighterclosedcalls.com and actually making the paper or the national headlines as an incident is the difference between having those policies and procedures and, most importantly, the training in place to make sure that we're operating in a, as the lawyers would say, in a safe and sane manner at all times. So we're now going to move on to our second topic and talk a little bit about front bumper extensions. Now, that seems to be, in some circles, people consider it to be an awful small area of concern, but one, again, that Michael and I feel very confident and important about for several reasons. So I thought it would be interesting to take an excerpt from a specification of a major city of how they describe in their specs the front bumper extension and what their expectation is in terms of how that is to be built and designed. So we're going to quote right off the spec and read a full few of the bullet points. And we're going to quote now at this point, the front bumper extension shall be fabricated of 80,000 PSI high tensile steel channel minimum, and then it has in parentheses the minimum acceptable dimensions of 9 inches high by 2 inches wide by 1/4 inch thick approximately, designed to protect the front of the apparatus from head-on and angled impact loads. Bumper shall be securely bolted directly to the frame members with the correctly sized grade 8 hardware. The extension members shall be painted black and the bumper face shall be painted red. The second bullet point in the spec, the bumper support brackets shall be attached directly to the chassis frame and shall have sufficient strength to withstand high impact. The bumper and brackets shall be bolted in place. The third bullet point, which is very significant and something that you don't normally consider on a fire truck, particularly those folks that are designing the rig, the bumper extension assembly shall be able to support the apparatus weight during towing / recovery procedures. The last bullet point, the front bumper extension shall be a maximum of 18 inches from the front of the cab. Then it goes on to discuss a little bit the two hose wells that this the department desired to have to carry a 35-foot length of 5-inch suction hose or soft sleeve and 100 feet of 1¾-inch hose in a trash line bin, and went on to describe the bins and that construction. What's significant that we want to highlight here is the fact that the bumper and your bumper extension should be designed with due consideration to protecting intrusion into the cab from some object that you may inadvertently hit, which in addition to protecting the front of the cab is also obviously protecting the operating members who are riding and driving the vehicle. Again, in the past, some folks have looked at the steel painted bumper as being, quote, the cheap and or inexpensive way to get a bumper assembly on a fire truck, with the thought process being that painted steel has got to be a lot less than chrome, which most bumpers today, candidly, on a fire truck are stainless steel and are not chrome-plated steel itself, back to the old-style bumpers. So the bumper and the bumper reinforcement is really there to protect the vehicle from an accident, so that you don't have the bumper fold up and go into the cab, and if you've hit a pretty substantial object along the lines of a telephone pole or a concrete pillar or an abutment or something like that, you now have that getting full intrusion into the cab, which means that the front fascia of the cab has given way, and that object is now inside of the cab itself. With bumper extensions, it's one of the areas that over the past 4 to 5 years, on different styles of apparatus, the available options have changed dramatically. We'll talk briefly about, you know, the common everyday engine, truck, and then heavy rescue, and look at how that these bumper extensions can either help or hinder us. Well, starting out with an engine, something that Michael only has minimal experience with because he stares at them all the time, but when we get to the ladder truck, we'll turn it over to him, and he can tell us some of the concepts that he's been involved with operating off a rear mount ladder for many years of his career. But on a pumper specifically, fairly common that people want to have a front suction of some description and a well to hold some amount of hose. Secondarily, the trash line has become almost standard on most pieces of apparatus, and you need to have room to have a discharge, typically 2 inch, sometimes 2.5 inch, and a swivel to be able to connect the hose to, and then some type will hold anywhere between 100 feet to possibly as much as 200 feet of a tack line hose and a nozzle. And depending upon manufacturer, you can generally find folks that will put that in somewhere between an 18 to 20 inch bumper extension. In a lot of cases, where the industry has gone from the manufacturing sector is they would prefer to have a longer bumper extension so they could engineer and migrate all their different options that conceivably could be fit into that bumper extension and push the extension out to 24, in some cases as much as 26 inches from the front surface of the cab. Now, what that means is you get all the goodies that you want up there on the front bumper with your pumper, but in some cases you're making that bumper extension artificially longer than it needs to be. So it's very easy from the manufacturer standpoint to say, instead of having to engineer a whole bunch of options for you on a pumper within an 18-inch extension and then revisit those to look at what it would take in a 24 or 25-inch extension, some builders have gone to, okay, we're going to engineer every option possible, and once you get past the standard smaller extension, we blow this out to 24 to 26 inches. Now, what that means in terms of apparatus maneuverability, it obviously, every couple of inches you add in your bumper extension, it makes the vehicle physically longer. If you happen to be operating out of a fire department station or headquarters that has very long, deep bays, you know, whether the vehicle was 32 feet 4 inches or 32 feet 8 inches probably really doesn't enter into a whole lot. There are some departments that have very, very tight quarters where, or have apparatus parked in tandem, one behind the other, that those couple of inches make or break the difference of the apparatus physically fitting into the station. That's one thought. Beyond that, but much more important, is every couple of inches that you add into the overall length of the vehicle, while it's great that we have all this technology with steering geometry and axles that give us up to 45 to 46 degree cramp angle with the smaller tires, your curb-to-curb turning radius can improve dramatically because of the steering geometry, but as the overall length of the vehicle grows, your bumper-to-back step turning radius still is a function of how long the vehicle is. So, as they say, size is important. It's really important with respect to the size of the bumper extensions, and you need to get the proper extension to make the proverbial bells and whistles fit on what you want on the front of the rig on a pumper. By the time you put your couple of hose wells and your intake and your discharge and then potentially your air horns are going in the bumper, the siren, electronic siren speakers, and if you're having some type of mechanical siren either recessed in the bumper or on top of the bumper with tilt cabs, that alone sometimes, by placing one of the more common sirens, the Federal Q2B siren, up on top of the bumper with many builders, that in and of itself requires that you go to a 22, 24, 26-inch bumper extension so that they don't have to limit the amount of cab tilt when you're tilting the cab up for service, or otherwise the front of the cab would come in contact with the siren. Now, as foolish as that sounds, that's a practical fact of life. So that's one of the reasons why you see people, and with some builders, take that mechanical siren and actually notch or pocket it in the front surface of the bumper. Why are they doing that? Is it that they didn't want to pay a couple extra dollars for that chrome rear pedestal on a siren? No. The thing was, they were trying to keep their overall bumper extension down, and by plopping the siren up on the bumper, that in and of itself caused the bumper extension to get longer. So a couple of things you need to be thinking about, all keeping in mind that whether you go for the, some people refer to it as the FDNY style painted or angled bumper, some builders offer that in a stainless steel version, or whether it is the standard, you know, 10-inch or 12-inch stainless steel bumper that your builder happens to offer, you always want to make sure that that bumper is properly reinforced back to the frame with the steel bumper backer, so that if you do get involved in any type of frontal or side accident in an intersection or someplace else, that bumper does not bend in where it's mounted up to the frame rail extension and simply fold into the cab. So those are the issues on engines. Now we take that one step further and say, okay, we now want some kind of bumper extension on our ladder truck. And for the moment, we're going to talk about a non-quint, something that doesn't have a pump and a tank. So the things that we would typically mount up on a front bumper are our warning devices, and in some cases, maybe a pair of hand tools or a couple of six-foot hooks or something like that. When we go to put a long bumper extension on a ladder truck, Michael, what's that do to us when we're trying to maneuver the truck into tight places where I know every once in a while I'll bet the engine guy doesn't pull just far enough past the building it. Now the truck's got to sneak in a little bit. How does that long bumper extension either help or hinder you when you're trying to position the truck?
Well, it's absolutely a detriment, Tom, to operations. That you just it just seems we're trying to go with this mantra that bigger's better. And when it comes to aerial devices, with the streets being more crowded with cars and pedestrians and other objects than they've ever been, a front bumper extension may not be the way to go. And interesting, as from a driving perspective, it's easy to go forward many times, but if you take even with a pumper in a rural or suburban setting and you go up that proverbial long driveway to the address, 600-800 feet off the main roadway, you take care of the situation, and now you have to leave and you're going to back down the driveway. As all good operational procedures should include, you should have a backer or spotter or one or two at the rear of the apparatus as you back out of the driveway. Well, as the driver, you're sitting up in the front seat and you're looking out the mirrors, hopefully, at one or both of your spotters. And in some cases, the apparatus are equipped with cameras. But in any event, you're backing out, and now you come to the main roadway. Where are you looking? Well, you're still looking at the spotters or in the TV camera screen for backing out, and you're not looking ahead at the front bumper extension, and that's at about the time when you turn the wheel and you clear out the lady's mailbox or take down one of the white street poles or a sign pole or something else at the foot of the driveway. And can do considerable amounts of damage, especially if the front bumper extension has built-in intersection lights. Well, that becomes a big problem, and get a lot of complaints or questions about that from time to time as it relates to the front bumper extensions.
Good point, Mike. And the thing is here, again, is that many people are seem to be overly, I want to say, hung up on the fact that the more massive or the longer we can put something off the front of the rigs, the better off we are. For the amount of time that Michael and I have been in the service, I frankly have a hard time believing that the physical size of the rigs, in terms of overall length, in some cases every once in a while the height, but certainly the length and the weight of these vehicles, in many cases, contributes to the fact that our drivers and operators, unless they're properly trained, have a very robust driver training program, or including a system, particularly in the volunteer service, where they have to annually or in some reasonable period of time requalify on the various units that they're accustomed to driving. It makes a big difference when you are responding to the fire station or getting to the station in your personal own vehicle and drop out of something that weighed 2,900 pounds and get behind the wheel of today, the average engine that would have a gross vehicle weight rating of somewhere between 44 to 48,000 pounds, or a ladder truck that, you know, be somewhere in the area of 60 to 72,000 pounds gross vehicle weight, and then find out that the handling and driving characteristics of those units is dramatically different from what we just left. And unless we are very, very comfortable and confident with our ability to handle and maneuver those units, particularly at very, very low speeds, but in very, very tight areas, that kind of sometimes distinguishes the difference between an operation that goes very well with a well-qualified driver versus one that, frankly, you have to look at it the scenario later on, and if you're really sincere about critiquing your operations, to say, the only thing we did is really get it there, and that was about it. Other than that, it just parked and was basically a planter box. Final thing on front bumper extensions, talking about rescue trucks. This is the area where I would say, you know, several years ago, this was the last bastion of space that we had found something to do with. It's not uncommon at all today to see rescue vehicles of different descriptions, both walk-ins and non-walk-ins, with bumper extensions that can include things such as 12,000 pound or 15,000 pound electric winch. Not a big deal. That easily bolts up in the frame rails and nominally fits in 17 to 18 inches of space for a bumper extension. Well, we took that one step further, and then we put the winch, and then we wanted a couple of tool compartments. And in some cases, because of what we wanted to put in those tool storage compartments up on the front bumper, that caused us to bump out the extension a few more inches from that 17 or 18 inches, and now we're out to 20 or 22 inches. Well, I'm not sure who the first person was to lay claim to have the first installation out in the country like this, but someone clearly was the first, and it's been copied many times over. By now, we've decided it would be a nice idea to put potentially an electric cable reel up in the front bumper extension. And more recently, now we can put hydraulic rescue tool reels up in the front bumper extension, together with the pre-connected rescue tool of your particular choice. Well, as soon as you go to put one of those reels in there, whether it's an electric cable reel, a hydraulic reel, or even in some cases I've seen air reels mounted on the front bumper, the bumper extension typically starts now at 24 to 25 inches and can go upwards of 26 inches and longer. Now, what does that mean? Well, a couple of things. Most manufacturers' cabs are somewhere between 72 to 74 inches. The shorter ones are about 68 inches from the front cab skin to the center line of the front axle. That's a dimension that's standard, and that's, depending upon your builder, that's the dimension you got to work with. It's the bumper extensions that we put on beyond that point that we're talking about. And if you have a 74-inch cab and you need to put, for example, a 28-inch bumper extension out on the front of that to make all your the goodies fit out on the front bumper, you're now out, you've got a bumper extension out over 100 inches. Now, again, if your drivers are very, very well trained and qualified to operate that and maneuver those in tight situations, that's one thing. The second concept is you've got so much hardware out on the front bumper in terms of dollar and cent value. You put a hydraulic, a 100-foot hydraulic hose reel out on the front bumper. The reel with the hose, depending upon what brand of tool you're running, they got close to $2,600, $2,800 worth of components right there. You throw a couple of other things out there on a hydraulic rescue tool. If you had a calculator, by the time you throw in the warning devices and everything else, not hard to come up with. You can have $8,000 to $10,000 worth of quote stuff and components hanging out on a front bumper. Is there anything wrong with that? Absolutely not. But now, in addition to wanting to have a bumper extension to protect intrusion into the cab, you want to have that bumper properly reinforced, or a steel bumper out there to protect all of the components that you've got out there. The first time you get involved in any kind of minor intersection accident, if you've got a hydraulic reel or an electric reel of some type that's mounted outboard of the of where the front frame extension is, if the bumper's not properly reinforced and the extension's not properly braced, when you get involved in any kind of accident, that whole thing is going to come and fold into the cab, and all you're going to do is have a whole bunch of wadded metal. Probably want to make sure that you're adequately covered with your insurance agent, because when the adjuster comes and is used to looking at trucks or class 6, 7, or 8 trucks that have been involved in an accident, and then go look and see what kind of damage you've done to your fire truck, you better believe he's going to be scratching his head and wondering, frankly, what the heck did we do here? So, word to the wise, that it's some area that you want to take under consideration, and probably a good thing to put into your specs, even if you're going to use some manufacturer's standard specifications to help you build your truck. You probably want to put in the language somewhere that the final layout and location of all of the components on the front bumper will be subject to fire department approval. That way, if you tend to get talked into something early on in the process before or the unit goes to bid, and then you find out afterwards, maybe when the blueprint finally gets synced up with the specifications, and you see what kind of dimension you're looking at and what the front bumper actually is going to look like, it gives you the ability a last time to have a sanity check. And always be upfront and ask the person you're working with, the salesperson or the representative from the manufacturer, with the things you want to put up on the front bumper, ask them if it could possibly be done in a shorter dimension than what they're proposing to do, and find out if you really need to make that bumper extension 26 inches or whether there's a possibility for making it a little bit shorter. Okay, next up on the list here, just before the break, I'm going to briefly talk about raised roof cabs versus interior heights. Now, this is probably appropriate with the safety stand down. If you think about it, it might be nice to get into a cab and stand straight up, but unless we're operating like a command unit on a rescue truck, most of us should not be standing inside the vehicle when we're moving down the road. So I'm not sure why you would need to have a cab with a 75-inch interior headroom height unless you've recruited a bunch of former NBA basketball players to come fight fires for you. But here's one of the trade-offs. Many departments in their specs get hung up on stipulating they want a 10-inch raised roof or a 20-inch raised roof. What you need to focus and look at is, say, what type of interior headroom height do you want to have available inside your cab? For example, to just say, I want a flat roof cab because you've got an overall travel height issue, or you want to put a light tower or something on the roof of the cab. A flat roof cab with current manufacturers, your interior headroom height can vary from as little as 52 to 53 inches to some manufacturers offer as much as 58 to 59 inches of interior headroom height. So let's take the example, a flat roof cab that offers 59 inches of interior headroom height. I've had departments tell me, we want a 20-inch raised roof. And they'll say, you know, when you inquire why, now we're talking about pumpers, they'll say, well, that's the highest roof that they make. And you ask them, well, what kind of interior headroom height are you looking for? Well, I don't know. Well, on the guy that builds his flat roof cab at 59 inches, and you put a 20-inch raised roof on that, you've got 79 inches of interior headroom height. There are other builders that offer a 20-inch raised roof that you get 71 inches of interior headroom height. So, again, it's kind of like bigger is not better here, folks, all right? From Mike and Tom, we can tell you that many of the departments that we've either done consulting work for or had the pleasure of coming in to go teach a class or had folks come up and talk to us, this is one of the things, I guess, one of the most often spec'd options on a fire truck, that after people buy one like that, they'll typically come back and say, we bought it, but we'll never do it again. You know, just because it fits the firehouse, your 20-inch raised roof extension, you've got 11-foot high doors, and a 20-inch raised roof has got an overall travel height of 121, 123 inches. Just because it fits in a firehouse doesn't necessarily mean that's the best thing for you, all right? So think about seriously how you're going to work and operate pumper and whether you really do need a raised roof cab. Is it a little bit more convenient for guys like me that are barely 5'10", that maybe, you know, not have to duck completely to get in the cab? Yeah, possibly. But if everybody's supposed to be seated and belted, the height of the raised roof cab to a point kind of becomes immaterial. And on a pumper, there are two distinct disadvantages for going for these high raised roof cabs. One is as follows. If you have a top-mounted deck gun, or where I started my career in Maryland, a wagon pipe, you put a 20-inch raised roof on a cab, what is it? The domino effect is, it now requires that you have to put an extender gun or some type of device on your discharge pipe on your gun so you can get 360-degree motion around the vehicle. There's a
you
lot
mean,
of components.
You mean, Tom, that one component actually affects another on a truck?
Yep, Mike, and even for us guys that predominantly squirt water, it certainly does. Now, there's Task Force, our sponsor, makes a wonderful device, an extended gun in a couple of different heights that will get you up above the raised roof portion of the cab. But one impacts the other. Now, the other thing, and again, this goes to one of my little favorite hotbed topics, talking about top mount pump panels. 9 out of 10 people, when you ask them, why did you buy a top mount pump panel? Right after they say, inherently, they believe it's safer, they say, well, it gives the pump operator a 360-degree view of the incident, of the fire ground or whatever. Well, if you got a 20-inch raised roof cab and the pump operator turns around, all he's typically looking at is aluminum tread plate or the painted back of the cab. So, you know, unless you gave him a step stool, he doesn't have 360-degree view of the fire ground, just like you didn't have 360-degree operation of the deck gun or the wagon pipe. So, again, just if your station has 11-foot or 12-foot doors, do not just get talked into the highest raised roof cab that people make because, quote, it'll fit the firehouse. And like any other educated consumer, if you don't have a raised roof cab and you're thinking about one, go talk to somebody that has one and operates one and get their feedback. On pumpers, they'll either work or not work, and it's pretty clear. Now, on ladder trucks, Michael, why would you not want to have a raised roof on a ladder truck? I mean, I gave you some reasons on pumpers. What's the deal with trucks?
First off, you would have to ask the question why you would want a raised roof anyway, and most commonly people specify raised roofs so you can stand in the back. Well, given the fact that 14 firefighters have died in the line of duty thus far this year in vehicle-related accidents, and the majority of those have been jettisoned out of the trucks due to the lack of seatbelts, then it kind of makes raised roof cabs making no sense at all, giving people the opportunity to stand up in the back of the apparatus. From a pumper standpoint, the only reason that I could potentially see is that once in a while you'll see departments, particularly in the southeast or out on the west coast, that have paramedic engines where they actually may have transport capabilities, and they'll have a stretcher or some other kind of medical chair in there where they're going to do patient care. But otherwise, just really, there's just so many negatives and not really a lot of positives. When it comes to a ladder truck, particularly an aerial tower or a tower ladder, I was at one major manufacturer within the past couple weeks, and on their particular product, with the raised roof cab, you can only work off the front of the truck with the bucket and the boom to 17 degrees. Take away the raised roof and you can gain another 6 degrees of usable space or scrub area on the truck, scrub area being defined as that area of the building that you could touch with the basket of a tower ladder or an aerial tower. And then that question comes up, well, what's the difference between an aerial tower and a tower ladder? An aerial tower is basically an aerial ladder where the manufacturer has built on a bucket at the end. And you can acquire those from such places as Pierce, American LaFrance LTI, KME, RK aerials, Smeal aerials, all make Emergency One aerials, all have aerial towers. For tower ladders, then you would go to Seagrave and the aerial scope, which I'm very familiar with, having worked in the city of New York, and that's our predominant aerial tower ladder. And then the other tower ladder is made by Supton Corporation out of Ohio. And so there's a difference between those two units. But when it comes to the raised roof issue, regardless of whether you have an aerial tower or a tower ladder, you will cut down the scrub area substantially, regardless of which manufacturer you choose to build a unit, because of the raised roof.
So Mike, good points. And just to finish up on this, all right, we covered engines and trucks. Again, with rescues, if there is a vehicle where a raised roof may be of some actual perceived benefit that you can get some practical use out of it, we'll throw this out, right? On a non-walk-in or walk-in unit where maybe you were considering doing carrying minimal personnel in the back portion of the cab, maybe even considering just doing like a three-door cab and having a command area back there where you were going to, you know, a resource area, for example, on a hazmat unit or something of that nature, there the raised roof where people would be walking in and out of the vehicle when it stopped and stationary and you would have increased headroom height, there would be a case where you would want to consider a raised roof cab. You would also want to consider that if you had a walk-in style body where you were going to have what people would call a walk-through from the back wall of the cab would be cut open to match out against an opening that would be in the front of the body that would allow people to move from the rescue portion of the body up into the cab and back and forth. If you don't have an overall height restriction in your station, and for example you had 76 or 78 inch high headroom in the interior of the walk-in portion of the rescue body, then it would be nice to have a similar, if not slightly less, height area that you could walk through to get up into the cab. And again, that typically is going to be used when the vehicle is stopped and stationary. The problem, frankly, becomes to the listeners, whether it's an engine or a truck or a rescue, my humble experience has been the more room you give firefighters to move around in, it tends to minimize the ability to keep folks seated and belted. If they can stand up and be comfortable, I've ridden on calls to in innumerable locations where people, I've seen them, they'd be seated and belted, but when they get a quarter mile away, you got a raised roof cab with forward-facing windows, they want to unbuckle, stand up, kind of check out what's going on as they're going in, stick their head out the window, just a whole bunch of things that it seems like it's very innocent until something goes wrong, and then you end up, we read about you somewhere. So, again,
my favorite mantra is, Tom, it doesn't matter until it matters. You can do all these unsafe things, and as long as everybody is okay, it doesn't matter. When somebody gets hurt, that's when the lawyers and everybody else gets involved, and then it truly matters. Well, I think it's time for our first break. Again, I'd like to thank TFT, Task Force Tips, for sponsoring the show today. And also just want to let all our listeners know we will be at the Firehouse Expo at the end of July. We're going to do a live podcast. We will answer your questions on air as you come to the show. Prepare your questions. Come in and see us. Take part in this live podcast at the Great Firehouse Expo in 2007 in Baltimore, Maryland. We're going to take a break right now, and we'll come back in a few minutes and talk about some more apparatus architect issues.
With less money and fewer firefighters, departments have to use their people in the smartest and safest ways. So the next time you're speccing an apparatus, think manual and remote control monitors. Why, TFT practically reinvented radio frequency handheld controls for monitors, flowing from 15 up to 2,000 gallons per minute. Since every firefighter counts, so does every purchase. We can help maximize your team's Firestream's performance today. Visit us at www.tft.com or give us a call at 800-348-2686.
Hello and welcome back to the Apparatus Architects here on radio at firehouse.com. Again, just a reminder that we will be doing a live Apparatus Architects podcast from the floor, from the classrooms at Firehouse Expo. It's going to be held on Friday at 10:15 a.m. In room 308, so please do stop by to see Mike and Tom, bring some questions. If you're looking for some advice, this is probably the best opportunity to walk away with it right then and there. And Mike, I just wanted to check with you. We know you've been working for months and months and months on the firefighter seatbelt study. How's that going?
It's going really well. We just started body scanning our first group of firefighters a week ago in Dayton, Ohio, at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, but we still need people to give measurements and to sign up. There are two ways that you can help us. One is we're looking for fire departments, big and small, to measure firefighters traditionally using tape measures and using a specific methodology. If you are interested in helping us, and we really could use your help, we promised Roger LaCour from Pierce Manufacturing that we'd have over 1,000 by now, and we're only at about the 700 mark, and largely in part due to Montgomery County, who has really come through for us. But if you would like to get those measurements and the methodology to do them and help us out, you can contact Roger at capital R, L, ACE, and then small letters ACKORE at piercemanufacturing.com. That's R. LaCour at piercemanufacturing.com, and he can give you the rundown on the measurements that we need to complete that study. If you would like to volunteer to become part of the database of the body scan study, you can go to www.totalcontact.com and sign up with Jen and Jen to take part in that study. And again, we could use all hands here. The more the merrier, as it were. Moving on with the rest of the show, we're going to talk about rear-mounted versus mid-mounted aerials and rear-mounted versus mid-mounted platforms. Just had a question, believe it or not, the day before yesterday, do they still make mid-mounted aerials? And the question is yes. The answer to the question is yes. They still make mid-mounted aerials, although they're not necessarily as popular as they once were. Most, if not many, are in the rear-mounted configuration. And then the question was asked, well, why? Why are they still being made? It has to do with the Northeast here. Manufacturers are acutely aware that many firehouses here in the old Northeast were built into the 1800s, some of them, and firefighters were responding out of these firehouses with horses and wagons and hand-drawn apparatus as well. And now we move into the year 2007, and we have 72,000, 74,000 pound fire trucks trying to occupy the same spaces and trying to respond. And so for one of the major pluses in a mid-mounted aerial ladder is that it sits lower into the chassis and it has a lower overall travel height, hence it can be backed into a relatively low station. Tom, do you have any measurements as far as the door width that they could back the thing into?
Well, Mike, you hit the nail right on the head with respect to the mid-mount aerial ladder devices. If you go back, once again, and for many of our listeners, this is going to be like with some of the fire service forum threads that are up there that are entitled Back in the Day. And for some of our listeners, if your tenure in the fire service has been 5 to 10 years or less, you probably don't even remember seeing these. But if you go back in fire service history, apparatus design back from the 50s into the late 1960s, if you were going to buy an aerial ladder device, your choices were either to buy a mid-mount aerial ladder where the turntables mounted right behind the cab, or a tractor-drawn ladder. It was in the 1967, I believe, that Seagrave was the first builder to develop and come out with a rear-mounted aerial ladder that was of a 100-foot design. And there were two different things that really drove Seagrave, and then America LaFrance was a reasonably fast follower. The next year introduced their rear-mount device. The Seagrave unit, for those historians, was called the Rear Admiral, and the America LaFrance device was called the Ladder Chief. Later on, was known as the Water Chief when some bright engineer at America LaFrance got the idea to put the waterway pipes on there, dual along the side of the aerial, so it didn't increase the overall travel height, and you had your first version of a automated ladder pipe. At any rate, the Seagrave design was driven by two things. One was that, in addition to Mike's correct assertion that there was an overall height issue, if a department was replacing a mid-mounted aerial ladder that was 75 or 85-foot device, the mid-mounted 100-foot device many times was too long for the fire station. So Seagrave had the concept, when they first designed the Rear Admiral, to have it mounted and positioned on a low-profile cab and chassis, which gave an overall travel height of just 122 inches, 10 foot 2 inches. And then they had an option, again, back in the day, that you could fold the handles down on the pedestal, on the turntable, for the operating controls for the aerial, that would get you down to 117 to 118 inches high. So the magic there was, to our listeners, if you had a fire station that had a 10-foot door and wanted to get a longer aerial device because your community was developing, but there was no way you were going to be able to increase the height of your door, enter the 100-foot rear mount aerial. Again, America LaFrance was a somewhat fast follower, about 12 to 14 months after Seagrave introduced their Rear Admiral, and the first several of those couple were delivered out in California, and then the city of Chicago really took off on those. Again, they had length and height issues in many of their stations in the city. I believe it was the city of New York back in 1968 time frame purchased one Seagrave rear mount and one America LaFrance rear mount and evaluated them. And as they say, the rest is history. You look at that was the start of FDNY beginning to move away from what had previously been an entire fleet of tractor-drawn ladders and to develop the mix that they now have in their aerial fleet of rear-mounted aerial ladders and a mixture of 75- and 95-foot tower ladders with just a few 100-foot tractor drawings still in the fleet. So it was a combination of those, that impact, and for the first, I'd say, 5 to 6 years after those rear-mount devices came out, I want to tell you, Seagrave was, frankly, in the time, was kind of laughed at by other folks in the apparatus industry saying, you know, this is a concept that will never catch on. Who would want to put a turntable at the rear of the body? Although there had been some units purchased in the 50s and early 60s on both Maxim and Mack chassis with Magaris, which was a German builder, those were rear mount turntable ladders, but they were very much in the style of European ladder trucks that had very minimal ground ladder carrying capability and just a very low open compartmented body. So there's the background, and if you look at how we've evolved today, when they say that history repeats itself, there are many departments now that are in the market for a 100-foot aerial device, and there's no way they can change the structure of their fire station. They can't, architecturally or from a structural standpoint, they can't raise the lintel on the door. They can't do anything to improve their or adjust their travel height, and they're pretty much locked in to a mid-mount device of some type. And there again was the advantage early on in the early 60s when the early versions of the Mac aerial scope first was developed and in use in New York City, and also developed by the Sutphin Corporation with a lattice type huck riveted aluminum design. Those first tower ladders were designed to fit into what would be reasonably low profile overhead doors. In today's marketplace, if you want a 100 or 105 foot tower, particularly on some of these larger high roof cabs, it's not uncommon at all that if you don't have a 14 foot door, you can't get one of those rear mounted towers in there, Michael. So therein is, in many cases, it's some departments are in the position where it's not an option that they could buy either one. In some cases, they may think that they want the other one, but it physically won't fit the firehouse because of those dimensional issues.
Yeah, and it's funny you bring that up, Tom, because on the consulting side, working with a customer now that has two travel restrictions. One is the firehouse itself, and the other is a tunnel that actually dissects their district in half with a very low clearance as well. And so the question wasn't whether they were going to buy a rear-mounted or a mid-mounted tower. Because of the overall travel height, it was a question of what mid-mounted tower are we going to buy that's going to be able to fit both of those situations. And if my recollection is correct, Europeans have been rear-mounting aerial ladders for years and years and years. And like you said, with the Seagrave Rear Admiral and then the American LaFrance, in U.S. fire apparatus service history, rear-mounting apparatus is fairly a new endeavor, no?
If you look at the entire history, you know, just not, you know, one or two decades to roll back to the 80s, but if you look at the entire history of motorized fire apparatus, you know, it started out with, it came from the horse-drawn era, and not that Michael and I are that old. We don't want listeners thinking that we were born in the 20s, all right? You figure that out when you come meet us down in Baltimore and just look at the combined number of gray hairs on our head. You figure out how old we are. But you go back to people came from horse-drawn and personnel-drawn city, straight-frame city service ladder companies that carry just ground ladders and some buckets and hand tools and so forth. As we moved into the motorized era, just about everything was tractor drawn because that was the original concept. Then we got into motorized straight frame aerial devices, and in the 30s, in the day, again, both Seagrave, Peter Pershing, and several other builders began to develop hydraulically raised aerial devices, and they were all largely midship mounted. When people wanted to have something longer than 65 or 75 foot working height on the aerial device, that typically meant that it required a tractor-drawn device because those longer devices simply were not available in a straight-frame configuration. Only because I know some of the fine history of the Syracuse, New York Fire Department, the Seagrave Corporation delivered their very first 100-foot steel aerial on a straight-frame device, on a straight-frame chassis, was delivered, contracted for in 1958 and delivered in 1959. So before that, where we've got people now that aerial devices can go, in some cases, one of the manufacturers built something up to 125 feet. In that era, the tallest device you could get on a straight-frame chassis midship-mounted typically was 85 feet, even if you had innumerable high-rise buildings. So if you had a 100-foot requirement for a ladder truck in that era, up through the mid-60s until the other builders kind of caught on, so to speak, you were buying something to bed in the middle, and it was a tractor drawn, and typically was a three-section 100-foot ladder. Think about that, right, what the overall length of those vehicles were. The four-section 100-foot only came as a result of a need for people that said, I need a 100-foot aerial ladder, but I can't afford the overall length of what that three-section ladder would be. So now you look at today's market, where are we at? just about everybody builds everything. So it's a matter of my favorite expression to go to Michael's is an educated consumer is our best customer. The advantages, inherent advantages of mid-mount versus rear-mount, some of those are very real. Many of those are just perceived in the eye of the beholder. But the combination and packaging of the compartmentation you need to have, the ground ladders that you need to carry, that in many cases, particularly with rear-mounted devices, the type of ground ladders, whether they are solid beam, pumper style, or truss style ladders, the two manufacturers that are out there that build the aluminum ladders, the Duo Safety Ladder Company in Wisconsin and the Alkalite Ladder Company down in South Carolina. And then if your department wants to carry wooden ladders made by the Alco Ladder Company out in California, the overbeam width of those ladders directly has an impact on what the travel height of your vehicle is going to be. And in that case, you need to sort all of that stuff out before you kind of figure out what direction that you need to go in. So the mid-mount versus rear-mount, I don't really consider it, Mike, a controversy. It's not like a side-mount versus a top-mount. Boy, I want to go point-counterpoint with somebody on that topic. But rear-mount versus mid-mount is not a controversy. It's a matter of what's going to work for your community. And, if you're out east here in many of the departments, it's the available travel clear door height in your fire station, that and or combination, as Mike mentioned, of physical obstructions that you have in your community, that's what's going to make the decision for you, and then you need to design something from there.
Right. What happens is that as much of a positive is to mid-mount an aerial and get a lower travel height, it also means a longer travel length, and so it becomes at times more difficult to drive around. If you think about it just from a purely pragmatic standpoint, by having the ladder off the roof of the cab and pointing it straight out the back of the apparatus, you've now increased the vehicle length by just a full cab width, versus the rear-mounted aerial that now rests on the cab and in some cases actually extends a little bit over the cab. So you've now lessened the overall length of the vehicle by a full four-door enclosed cab length. And particularly in urban areas, that becomes a really big deal as far as driving it around and getting it to fit places. On the tower ladder side, again, get often asked this question, rear-mounted versus mid-mounted, which has a better scrub area, which is more usable? And again, interesting, went to a manufacturing facility a couple weeks ago and asked the question of the engineering group, and they gave the wrong answer because in many cases they just don't understand how the vehicles are being used. In any case, the best scrub area is achieved by buying a mid-mounted platform. It has a better angle of departure angle off the side of the truck, which is certainly helpful when you're trying to fight store fires and strip malls, and you need to get the bucket just a little bit off the sidewalk to get that stream into the cock loft. Another advantage of a mid, as far as scrub area, all of the mid mounts, or most of them anyway, are five section vehicles versus the rear mounts, which are three and four. And so the ladder sections themselves on the rear mounts are much longer. On the mid mounts, the ladder sections are shorter, which means you can position the vehicle closer to that row of stores or that fire, and then when you scrub the building from left to right and right to left, you haven't extended the ladder that much, and now you've made up that in scrub area from side to side. Also, with the turntable of the mid-mounted tower sitting lower into the chassis, it has a better negative angle of departure off the side of the apparatus versus the rear-mounted tower, which the turntable sits higher up in the chassis so that the ladder and the bucket can clear the roof of the cab, and hence it sits higher up in the higher up into the chassis, where it has a less favorable angle of departure or off the back of the rig when you go to work at a negative angle. And this is a buyer beware. Some tower ladders or aerial towers rear mounts and mid mounts have better scrub areas than other. Part of that is based on design, and then the part of that is based on the customer. We find many fire departments that clutter the side of the apparatus up with light cord reels and lights and all these other saw boxes and cabinetry. If you want a rescue truck, go buy a rescue truck, but certainly you don't want to inhibit any of the movements of your $800,000 aerial tower by cluttering up the side with tools and compartmentation and cut down the functionality of the aerial device itself that you paid a huge amount of money for. Any thoughts on that, Tom?
Yeah, two great points. To wrap up on the discussion here, and again, we'd be more than happy to entertain discussions and interaction at our upcoming live podcast on Friday at 10:15 down at the Baltimore Fire Expo. But two key components to think about, all right? When you're evaluating new apparatus as either a new aerial device or a replacement device, you really need to focus in on two important things, all right? Neither of which probably the vendor and or the salesperson is going to highlight. One is that, with few exceptions, in the life of the vehicle, you will use, in a fire ground incident, the ground ladders and the tools and equipment off that vehicle 8 to 10 times for every one time that the aerial device goes up in the air to do something, either to potentially effect a rescue, get personnel to the roof, or to possibly operate in a water tower configuration. So do not be mesmerized by the size of the vehicle, the warning lights, the fact that it has this kind of suspension system, and it has large, you know, disc brakes, and it has polished aluminum rims that are polished on both the outside and the inside, and all that cool stuff. That's good stuff, but you need to make sure that you have the proper amount of ground ladders on the device to do what you need to do in your community. That's issue one. Issue two is to make sure that if, in the event that you do not have an overall height issue in your station or your community, just because you have a rear-mounted device now, do not exclude the fact that you should open your eyes and see potentially what a mid-mount device could or couldn't do in your community, and vice versa. Many people, it's kind of like they get into this syndrome of buying a replacement for a car or a vehicle. I have a good friend of mine that several years ago bought a big dual-tire, diesel-powered, four-door cab pickup. Why? I guess he had to get it out of his system. It's just like us firefighters. Until you buy the 10-person raised roof, you can't describe it, 38-foot Wonder Wagon, you have to get it out of your system. Well, given the current price today of both petroleum, gasoline products, and diesel fuel, I happened to run into this fellow the other day and asked him what purposes he was using this big pickup. You know, was he hauling stuff? Was he pulling a trailer? And he goes, nah, I thought I was going to do all that, but I didn't. It's just basic transportation. I said, well, if you're going to, you know, and he was thinking about maybe buying a new one. I said, well, are you going to buy something smaller now that, you know, fuel prices are up and everything? Nah, he goes, once you kind of get into this, he goes, it's, you have to keep buying the same thing or bigger. And unfortunately, that comment that came from my good friend is kind of sometimes the same thing that happens to us in the fire service. Once we get to a certain size vehicle, we just want to keep getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And that's okay if you have a need for it and you can demonstrate that you have a real reality need for that larger device. Just to buy it bigger for the sake of buying, you're coming out of an 85-foot device and now you feel 104 is what I need. Maybe that's the case, but if it's not, going from that 85-foot tower that you bought in 1988 that back then probably carried 167 feet of ground ladders if you didn't ask anybody, and your new device shows up, and if you buy a Quint and it has the 104-foot device but it only shows up with 85 feet of ground ladders, you maybe took one step forward and two back. So you need to be thinking about those things. Okay, moving on. We're going to finish up here by answering a couple questions for things that have come in from our listeners and the readers of our column over the course of the last couple of weeks. And one comes in from a department that wanted to know if there were any definitive studies that showed the colors of fire apparatus to be one color to be more effective and/or safer than another color. And specifically, they were addressing the old, somewhat old controversy of lime green or a shade of green fire trucks. That was what their current fleet, how it was colorized, and they wanted to move towards red. And they were looking for some definitive study or report to be able to validate why that red color or some shade of red or red and white was safer. And if any listeners are aware of any type of scientific studies that have been done or something that's been done at a college or university level, Mike and I would certainly like to be made aware of that or possibly get a copy of the study. But going back to the days in the mid-1970s when Dr. Stephen Solomon from Owego, New York, did some study and research, part of which was subsidized by the now late Ward LaFrance Fire Truck Company, that promoted the concept that lime green or a combination of white and lime green were more discernible to different age ranges of both males and females in the population, and was actually a more effective and efficient color. Beyond that, there frankly hasn't been any definitive data or studies done by either a research organization, a fire apparatus builder, or a community to really amplify off that study to, in fact, prove that lime green or some shade of whatever you want to call it is, in fact, safer. Many, many fire departments over the course of years that had their apparatus painted some color have, for whatever reason, either due to improved morale within the fire department, to go back to a more traditional color, to kind of reinvent themselves or change up how they wanted to be perceived by the community. In some cases, that community could have been the local populace. In some cases, it was to satisfy politicians, very candidly, have migrated away from whatever color their rigs were previously to go to some shade of red or some paint scheme of white over red, however that might be. So that was a great question. Unfortunately, there's no documented scientific information that Mike and I are aware of, particularly anything that's been done, say, in the last 5 to 6 years, to ram that concept home, that what was popularized back by Dr. Solomon, that without a doubt, you know, after you read his data and research, would certainly lead you to believe that lime green was the only way to go. But there hasn't been anything to amplify that or to substantiate that over the course of the last couple of years. And whenever that somewhat controversial topic comes up, you get people immediately to divide up sides, and probably for every department that at some point changed their paint scheme from whatever they had to go to lime green or white over lime green, you could cite 10 or 15 departments that went in the other direction that painted their apparatus another color and went back to some shade of traditional red. So again, there it's much over mind over matter in that area. It's a matter of what people might want. Now, over the course of the last couple of weeks here, winding down, there's been a number of very unfortunate, and in some cases very tragic, with serious injuries that resulted of runaway apparatus accidents. And Mike, would you like to comment on that?
Yeah, there just seems to be a growing number, Tom, of apparatus that just take off. We had one department in the Midwest who was on scene by being the time was actually tracked by Firecom, and they were on the scene for 18 minutes, and although the unit wasn't chocked, the unit had its air brakes, the maxi brake on, and in the 18th minute of being on scene of this NVA with nobody around the truck at all, it just all of a sudden took off and rammed into the back of the ambulance. Fortunately, there were no injuries, but you just have to wonder why, and I think we need to challenge the apparatus manufacturers at this point. I don't have the answers, but is it because of the electronics? Did somebody try to open a garage door? Did somebody key a radio mic? Did somebody make a cell phone call or receive a call? Or really not clear on what's going on, but over the course of the last 18 months, I have pictures of 9 apparatus that have run away in some regard or another. Has it always happened? Yeah, we had it in pumps and we had the maxi brake on, and a lot of times it wasn't necessarily in pumps, but it was in drive. And we actually did some studies in New York City at the Division of Training, where we would put the apparatus in drive, put the maxi brake on, and see if the apparatus would run away. And we actually expanded that study off of New York City to other apparatus because we were and still are purely Seagrave, and we found that somewhere between 1300 and 1700 RPMs, all the apparatus that we tested would overrun, would override the maxi brake even if it was on, to the point where a brake manufacturer actually came to New York and said, well, it can't do that, and we'll put it up on a lift and make sure the brakes are adjusted. And then we took it out in front of a training academy, and it ran right down the road, and it overrode the brake system at about 1,400 RPMs. So it's occurring. It's occurring with frightening regularity now, and we need to start asking some questions and figure out why there seems to be such a high propensity recently of runaway apparatus. A couple other comments. Public comment is now open on the automotive specification, NFPA 1901. That public comment period is open until August, so you may want to go to the NFPA website, look over that document, and if you have any comments, it tells you and shows you how you can submit them to the full 1901 committee. Also, have had some people come up to me in the last several weeks and talk about the low sulfur diesel fuel. There have been several departments that have had older apparatus where they put the low sulfur diesel fuel in, and they have had troubles to some varying degrees. Again, really don't know the answer to that question, other that we're going to try to do some research in the next month or so and find out what's going on with that. It kind of makes sense that when you have a change like that, there could be some potential problems, but we just don't have the answers yet. It's too early, but we are going to look into that and hopefully have more information on that next month in the next show.
Very, very good, Mike. Well, we'd just like to wrap up by thanking all of our listeners, and especially thanking the Task Force Tips for sponsoring the Apparatus Architect podcast. And again, remind everyone that Michael and myself will be putting on a couple of inside program presentations during the Firehouse Expo on Thursday, the 26th of July, and would ask you to simply refer to the firehouse.com website or the inserts that have appeared in the Firehouse magazine to see the dates and the exact times for those two programs, including one that Mike and I are very proud and very happy to present called Are We Really Operating Safe Fire Apparatus? And then on Friday, the 27th, at 10:15 in the morning, we will be doing a live podcast in room 308 with Michael and Tom and our able assistant, Mr. Peter Matthews, at our side, and would encourage everybody to come down for that. If nothing else, it would be worth your time to come, get informed, stay safe, and to watch Brother Wilbur operate at the ungodly hour of 10:15 in the morning. That alone, brothers and sisters, worth the price of admission itself. So this is Michael Wilbur, Tom Shan saying thank you very much for listening in here to this latest edition of our Apparatus Architect podcast, and we look forward to seeing you all down in Firehouse the week of July 23rd. Thank you very much. Everybody, please stay safe.
If you have a comment on this program, drop us a line at radio@firehouse.com. Thanks for listening. And stay tuned to Firehouse.com for more broadcasts like these. Or visit our website at www.firehouse.com/radio.